This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for January 28th, 2021, the short squeeze edition. I am David Plotz of CityCast. I am in Washington, D.C., where I'm joined... Oh, it's not joined by anybody, anywhere. What am I talking about? I'm joined by my cat. I'm joined by one of my children.
That's not so bad. A cat,
but
a
I'm just going to be like, I'm joined by you guys. I'm definitely not joined by you guys.
We would love
Joined in a Zoom sense by Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School from New Haven. Hello, Emily.
Hey, David.
And also in a Zoom sense by John Dickerson of CBS 60 Minutes from Manhattan, I think. Hello, John.
Yeah, I'm from Manhattan at this juncture.
Oh, yes, you're in my old room there, it looks like.
Yeah, the David Plotz room, which is being kept at the ready for your next arrival when we get through this plague.
I look forward to it. Today, we're talking about the crisis in the Senate, in the world's greatest deliberative body. I'm going to say that phrase over and over again today. Can the world's greatest deliberative body, that's all said dripping with irony, if you couldn't tell, accomplish anything? Then the deplatforming of Donald Trump and some of his supporters. Is there a better way to reduce lies and hateful speech? Should private companies be responsible for that kind of policing? Then the curious case of GameStop. Felix Salmon of Axios and the Slate Money podcast will join us to explain one of the weirdest finance stories of this year or any year. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. The Senate is poised in an indelicate balance. It is a 50-50 Senate. And yet, no one is quite sure what it's going to do, whether it can do anything, how it will accomplish what it's going to do. There are several members of the Senate, notably Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz, who promoted a mob to attack the Capitol to overturn the election. They seem to not be bearing any responsibility for that. There's an impeachment trial that is scheduled that is also not going to go anywhere because of Republican intransigence. Meanwhile, Democrats who control the Senate in some sense because of the vote of Vice President Kamala Harris wish to push through huge bills, both temporary relief bills and larger structural reforms, both at a budgetary level and to things like voting and the number of states we have. And yet they don't necessarily have an effective majority to do that. There are a handful of moderates, a handful of centrists, I would say, people who are not on the extreme of either party, in the middle, and they exist in one space. There's a whole bunch of Republicans who refuse to distance themselves from President Trump, former President Trump, who continues to poison the political landscape. It's a really complicated situation. And then there's the question of the filibuster and reconciliation. John, so in this complicated state, I want to focus on the small question. How does a relief bill get passed through the Senate? It feels to me like there are three different ways it could get passed. As a bipartisan bill, as a Democratic bill shoved through using reconciliation, or a full abandonment of filibuster using a majoritarian principle that and getting rid of the filibuster as a thing.
I think that's right. I would split the second option into two, which is a bill just supported by the Democrats that's the big full or something close to the big full Biden plan, and then a bill pushed through by Democrats using reconciliation that's pared down. The difference between those two may be determined by a choice of the president and Republicans, or maybe determined by the parliamentarian who determines what can pass through reconciliation and what can't.
And now, John, you could explain the Byrd rule.
Right. The Byrd rule, broadly speaking, sets the rules for part of reconciliation that require spending to be to meet certain criteria, would it have to be offsets for new spending? And
no wonder I can't remember it. It's like really complicated. It's not just like, okay, you have to have spending as what you're doing through reconciliation.
Also, I think there are the rules for reconciliation that are distinct from the Byrd rule. And so the reason this gets interesting is that some things like a change in the minimum wage or a federal minimum wage of $15, some people argue would not be allowed through reconciliation. Bernie Sanders said it can be done, and it just requires some, you know, artful lawmaking. But the big question, I think number three, David, getting rid of the filibuster is not going to happen because at least two Democratic senators, Sinema of Arizona and Manchin of West Virginia, have said they won't do it. So that's not going to happen.
I'm sorry, John, to interrupt you, but I just need to get indignant. I mean, it's absurd. This is a body that's job is to consider and pass legislation. And we're talking about something called the Byrd rule. Byrd is Robert Byrd, who is a Democratic senator from West Virginia who died probably 15 years ago, at least, was a powerful force in Democratic politics for many years. But why are we yoked? Why do we exist yoked to some set of bizarre, you know, arcane rules that this body, you know, passes at some point back in history to allow itself to sneak through one particular bill that needs to sneak, but then carries the weight, the heavy weight of tradition. This is Byzantine Empire shit here. This is the stuff where you've gotten so calcified and so locked in that you can't do anything. John Dickerson, an incredibly smart, deeply knowledgeable, you know, person who has studied American politics and American history and the American legislative process, like, are trying to talk about the Byrd rule. You're not even sure what it is. It's just something that it is, that's a yoke around the neck of the Senate. It's absurd. I don't know that getting rid of the filibuster is like a thing to do, but it's like, it's a ridiculous, the way this body works is ridiculous.
Ridiculous. That may be so, but when you have institutions and they decide for one reason or another to constrain themselves after particularly 4 years
I'm
of
all
the presidency,
for, I'm
totally
all for
got
institutions
rid of all
constraining
of
themselves. But like, let's like have constraints that sort of bear some relationship to the job that the institution needs to do.
But David, you're usually all about like politics and deal making, and they have to work this out. And this is their kind of leftover constraint that they continue to operate under because they haven't figured out, you know, either as a matter of inertia or politics, how to move off it. But the point to me about the number two option and its sort of 1A and 1B guises that John laid out is that it's totally possible, right? Like the Democrats can just get rid of the Byrd rule. They can decide that, you know, for this one time only or in some way that's not entirely getting rid of the filibuster, they are going to pass whatever they want through reconciliation. And it's really up to Sinema and Manchin what flies, right? Like these rules, the majority has control over the rules, doesn't it, John?
Right. Yes. And, roughly speaking. But the point of the Byrd rule, by the way, well, there are six tests or seven tests. I can't remember that for what's extraneous.
Does it float?
The larger,
then it's a witch.
The larger point of the Byrd rule is legislating should be done through committees and it should be done through a process. And don't try and shove things that don't have budgetary impacts through in reconciliation, which should be used narrowly. So the broader goal of the Byrd rule seems one, though it might be misinterpreted or misapplied or poorly used, the broader goal of the Byrd rule is do things the right way where the most people can, where the people who represent the largest number can have input in these pieces of legislation. Don't try to take them in through a back door. So that general principle is not one that's insane.
Well, first of all, it is kind of insane when you explain it that way. There's six or seven principles in order to fit things in the certain category of bill that we've decided should be able to pass by the majority, but other kinds of bills we should not be allowed to be passed by the majority. They must be passed through the 60-vote principle, which didn't really even exist until a generation ago and wasn't used in the way it was.
Well, those are two
used.
Separate things.
I mean, it's a body that is kind of locked in. It's like it has some kind of disease where everything is is tied together in this way. It can no longer move. It's those people, there's what's that disease where your bones keep growing and you lose the ability to move? Like that. That's what the Senate has. I definitely believe in institutionalism. I believe in politics. I think, you know, doing something where you get 55 votes, 57 votes, great. But this body is so screwed up right now that you can pass this one reconciliation bill, but you can't, they won't even be able to like consider a $15 minimum wage, something the overwhelming majority of Americans support, won't even be able to consider, you know, statehood for Puerto Rico or DC or some of the voting rights reforms Emily talks about, even though they have vast majority support because of the kind of blocking power that exists in the body. So that seems problematic.
But I think your argument is more against the filibuster than the Byrd rule. You could argue that it's because of the Byrd rule that there might be a change in the filibuster.
Well, I think David would say get rid of the filibuster, but then I sort of retreated to, okay, well, that's not possible right now. So, like, what can we do to drive a truck through it, basically? Which seems like
But I think the focus of ire should be at the filibuster, not the Byrd rule.
The focus of ire should be at a parties that are unable to work together, notably a Republican Party that simply refuses to act as a legislative partner 99% of the time.
Because it has decided
to make a death pact with a former president.
Well, right, but the Republicans if they don't support what's in the bill, they don't have to vote for it. I mean, that's their choice. The question is whether the institution and the Democrats who don't want to change the rules away from the supermajority, like, are they going to continue along that path? I mean, I feel like Jamel, among other people, has put this well. It's a choice between a party that doesn't want to do anything, and that is to the Republicans' advantage, since they're not in control, versus a party that has promised a lot, but is wearing handcuffs at the moment, and is only going to be able to do some of it. You know, I actually think that some of what the Democrats are proposing has a pretty good shot of getting through. And if the Republicans want to shoot down the $15 minimum wage, maybe there'll be political repercussions for that.
I think, I guess where I would retreat is to, we're operating in an environment here that makes all of the traditional ways of operating in the Senate really up for new assessment and up for grabs. You have a number of senators who supported either actively supported the president's big lie or did nothing to speak out against it. There's basically no more dangerous thing that was bouncing around. And if they couldn't unblock themselves from partisanship to speak out against the president until after there was an insurrection, and even then some of them didn't, you're no longer operating in a body where the norms and traditions and the ideas of bipartisanship are accessible. Because traditionally what you would say is, some of these rules should stay in place so that you force people back into negotiation and into compromise. And the reason there's a benefit in that is that the losing team feels like they had a say. And if they feel like they had a say, they live to fight another day within the body and they don't choose to take their fight outside of the body. Or it just is a more orderly way of doing things. But we have a situation in which the idea of bipartisanship couldn't even break through when the big lie came around. So why is it going to break through any of these other pieces of legislation? I mean, some, like infrastructure, maybe you could get people to operate in their own self-interest for their states and get 60 votes. But the moment we're at is one in which you can't rely on the now let us all reason together, because in the moment when people should have been reasonable, they weren't. That's the great moment we're in right now. I think, Emily, the idea that people would pay a price if, say, they voted against the minimum wage, that's possible. But the whole reason we're in this sticky moment is that so many states have become, and so many elections are based on, basically just what your base wants, that you might not have that kind of penalty you used to pay in the old days where you had a whole bunch of voters in the middle who sloshed around. But having said that, we also saw the changes we saw in Georgia. And so where you had a traditionally red state elect two Democratic senators. So maybe those kind of penalties and prices are possible. I don't know then, having gone through that, whatever I just said, is what really that points to in terms of how we get out of this moment we're in.
I think one of the things that's so peculiar about this moment to me is It was clear that Mitch McConnell wanted to cause a break from Trump, a true rupture from Trump. And there was a moment, and that moment is clearly passed, where had the party as a whole in the Senate acted, they could have effectively purged him. They could have decided. And McConnell definitely seemed to want to do it. He was angry about what literally happened, and I think he felt the baleful effect that Trump was going to have, the way that Trump was going to poison the Republican Party for the next few years and dominate it. And so he wanted it, him purged. And McConnell tried to act, and it has failed. The party has circled back around Trump ever more so. And what do you think, Emily, the implications of that are? That you have the, you know, 30% of Republicans don't love Trump, but the vast majority do. That 30% doesn't have any power, apparently, to influence what goes on.
Right. I mean, impeachment is super unpopular among Republicans. And once that poll started to come out, that seemed like that was going to be the answer, that it would take some extraordinary shift among the base and the Republican Party to shift senators, and it's not there. Fox and OAN and whatever else, Newsmax, are like feeding into the feeling of aggrievement about impeachment. So, I mean, I think it's going to be, it's really important for there to be a fair trial in which the senators weigh the evidence. Like, the Senate at this point has to go through that exercise. Though I understand why Senator Tim Kaine suggested a bipartisan censure instead, because this is going to suck up time and energy at a moment when the country really can't afford to expend a lot of that. But I don't think that that idea is going to go anywhere. And so we are going to have the public airing of the president's role in the Capitol assault. I hope we find out some more information about what led up to the assault in the planning, but also I'm still stuck on the delay in response. We got a little more from the acting head of the Capitol Police this week, but we have never heard publicly from the actual decision makers that day. And I'm still curious and worried about that. And then obviously there are also this other information that's come out, I think, since we taped our show last week about the Justice Department and the way in which Trump was trying to manipulate federal law enforcement to feed into and promote his lies about the Georgia election. So I hope they introduce some evidence about that, though I don't think it's clear whether that's the case or not.
Can I say one more thing about reconciliation? What? You know, the one thing that's an unfortunate byproduct of having to work through. So there's the tactical question of whether you go fast or go big that Democrats have to decide about. But then there's also, it would be nice if there were a forum to adjudicate some of the questions, particularly for me, the Republican opposition to a relief bill, which is founded in some part on this idea that you can't spend all this money because of its effect on the budget deficit. Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Fed, basically shot that down on Wednesday and said the most dangerous thing is if you don't have vaccinations, which this money would go to, and if you don't have money in the economy to the people who are hurting, that there's danger there too, and that the danger of inflation is actually, he actually said we could use a little inflation. And obviously there's the political lack of good faith among many of the people who are making the budget deficit argument because they didn't care very much when Donald Trump didn't care about budget deficits. And so that's a kind of a phony thing. Or if people want to try and make a real case for it, there should be a forum for this debate to happen. And if we get into a reconciliation, no reconciliation conversation, as important as it is, it tends to basically be an important structural question or tactical question, but kind of takes us away from the really interesting substantive issues that should be debated, because they're going to be debated now and basically for the rest of Biden's term, this question of whether money should be spent now for the purposes of investment versus, you know, any negative budgetary effects.
Slate Plus members, you get bonus segments on this podcast and other Slate podcasts. You support the excellent journalism that Slate does. If you go to slate.com/gabfestplus, you can become a member today. Our Slate Plus topic today is going to be about organization. John Dickerson is a man of many talents. One of his greatest talents is he is exceptional. He's exceptionally thoughtful about organization. I don't even know if he's actually organized. He just thinks a lot about
that's organization. That's a great distinction.
And he's going to walk us through his process. And if Emily and I have processes, I'm not sure I do. We will talk about those.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest, biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Emily, what is deplatforming and is it good or bad?
Deplatforming is taking a person off a social media platform or taking down an entire social media platform, depending on who is doing it. So the two big examples since January 6th have been Twitter permanently suspending President Trump and Facebook indefinitely suspending him, pending now a review by Facebook's new oversight board, which will be an interesting thing to watch. And then the other important move was that Amazon Web Services de-hosted Parler, which was this new, more right-wing platform that had started up. And so that's like, you know, Parler's like, I don't like your newspaper, I'm starting a new newspaper. And then the ink manufacturer says, I'm not selling you ink anymore. It's like at a different level in the stack, as people describe, like all the services that go into being up online. Whether it's good or bad, I mean, I think in the short term, it appears both the Trump deplatforming and probably Parler, and also like the taking down of tens of thousands of accounts associated with QAnon, it's correlating right now with a decrease in disinformation online generally, which seems like, okay, well, we all need some relief from that, given the damage that, you know, the lying has done before and since the election. The larger question, though, about the precedent we're setting here, all the power that this handful of oligarch tech companies have in determining what kind of speech is in what is effectively a public square, those are like really hard questions to answer. And, you know, I ended up in this piece that I wrote from the Times saying basically that, like, we don't want the government to make these decisions. We don't really want the tech companies to do it, but we don't want no one to do it. And so we're sort of stuck right now without a clear solution.
So what's wrong with the government doing it? What's wrong with the tech companies doing it? And who could do it if neither of them is the appropriate group to do it?
Well, you know, traditionally with free speech, you always worry about the government doing anything that approaches censorship, right? Like, that's a deeply held principle of the First Amendment. We didn't always interpret the First Amendment that way in this country. Really, it's like since the 1960s that we all fully got on board for that. But like, we're fully on board. I mean, I don't hear any proposals for like a federal Department of Content Moderation that would make direct decisions about what you can post on any social media platform. That's really antithetical to the First Amendment tradition. And I would argue to European free speech traditions as well, which are somewhat different than ours. The problem with the tech companies doing it is that it can seem pretty arbitrary. They don't have to explain. They don't have to be consistent. And the chances that they're going to stick with the kinds of decisions they're making now, which seem to be leading to a healthier news environment online, are like minuscule, because the algorithms by which they operate are profit driven. And the kind of hot, insightful content that they generally promote keeps people engaged. Lies tend to spread faster than the truth online. And presumably, we're going to go back to more of that default place. Having nobody do it means that you have like a ton of hate speech and disinformation online, and that doesn't seem so great either. One question I have is, you know, whether there are sort of middle ground regulatory solutions here. I think the Europeans are going to come up with them faster than the United States. And what's interesting to me about writing in this space is how, I mean, part of it's like they are kind of technical, and so, you know, it's not like you can capture them in one phrase. But I think also there's a lot of resistance to just the idea that the government has any kind of regulatory authority here. And I get why, for all of the like government censorship reasons that I was talking about. But I think in the end, it blocks the kind of more like nimble thinking that we really need right now.
What are the Europeans likely to do, Emily, that makes sense?
Well, so one obvious thing is like, you could start with this. Let's have the companies come up with a code of conduct and some standards, and then some way to hold them to those standards. Like right now, we don't have any idea what they're doing in their black box. Like they control whether independent researchers even have access to the data that would allow us to know whether they're doing what they said they were doing. So like, that's pretty hands off. Or you could have the government come in and help set some standards. Like maybe the algorithms should not be entirely in the hands of the companies. One idea that's popular in Europe right now, or popular is the wrong word, but being bandied about, is users choosing algorithms. Like the platforms would have to offer different options. I'm skeptical about that. It's the way the privacy law operates in Europe. And if you're anything like me, when you're in Europe and you get those like little notices that are like, will you accept these cookies? If you want to read it, you just click OK. And like, I don't trust myself to be like informed and smart enough to pick the right algorithm. But I think the idea that maybe we should set some limits on how these algorithms operate, like, that seems like maybe a good idea to me. I mean, again, it involves the government in some way in speech regulation. So you have to think about who you're handing that tool to. Would you rather basically want Mark Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey always making these decisions behind closed doors for whatever political reasons? Or would you rather have some government agency that the Europeans set up, or that, you know, states or the federal government sets up, that has some oversight rule here? The way we used to do with broadcast TV and radio between like the 20s and the 80s.
Right. I like the idea that you tell the companies you are going to set up a set of rules, which are going to be transparent about what those rules are, and then we're going to hold you to account. I mean, I think the thing that is so troublesome, one, is Facebook in particular has a long history of saying it's doing one thing and then just lying about it and going and doing something else. I mean, there's this whole thing about how they were not directing people towards certain kinds of groups. They said that very publicly, and turns out it seems like they were directing people towards those groups, even as they weren't. So that's one big problem. The other problem is that the fundamental business model of Facebook is so based on making people riled up. It's to keep everyone at a simmer, you need to allow enough hateful content to keep people engaged. So that's another issue. A third issue is that you can do these things in the US or in Europe. Facebook operates all over the world. Twitter operates all over the world. And they have not shown the same eagerness to deplatform in other countries as they may have here, where they're under a closer microscope. So there's this damage that Facebook in particular, I think, does all over the world, that even if you constrain them in the US, that might not necessarily mean the sum total of human suffering that they're creating is reduced. So I get worried, but I like your proposal, Emily. I like the proposal of they set up principles that we hold them to those principles and see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, like, here's another idea, and this isn't my idea. It comes from, like, Kate Starbird at the University of Washington. I think Ellen Goodman at Rutgers has talked about this, too, that you would have, like, a circuit breaker. So if the platforms know which accounts are the huge spreaders of disinformation. That's not a secret. We can see that. Kate Starbird has this list that she published before the election. So once you're a known spreader of disinformation, maybe there should be some kind of, like, break on how fast the content travels that comes from your account. Something in the algorithm that says, like, wait a second, we're going to check first to make sure this is not hate speech or disinformation before we promote it and amplify it with the algorithm, right? I think sometimes what gets lost, like a principle I keep returning to, is that the algorithm is not, there's no like perfect abstract algorithm that is like the law of the land. The algorithm is always making choices. It's always shaping and in some ways manipulating the content that we see before us. And so the idea that you would want to push the algorithm in certain instances to be wary of disinformation seems like bare enough to me.
I feel like there are two big things, two different kinds of speech that we're trying to get a handle on here. One is the vast amount of misinformation that exists that causes people to believe things that aren't true, that causes them to, you know, then that causes the big lie to take hold in the way it did. And that is fundamentally runs through these big algorithms as it runs through Facebook, which have this real power to multiply and speed up the dissemination of that. The second kind of information is the ability of bad actors to plan things and to organize together and to plan mischief, criminal conduct. And those are two different forms of speech that you want to monitor and control. And in fact, trying to control the first sort, which is the big lie, misinformation, may actually enable the people, the bad actors, to hide more, that they will retreat to things that are more hidden platforms and be able to stay out of sight of law enforcement. Is that a problem, Emily?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this has happened too with like WhatsApp groups that, you know, Facebook, which owns WhatsApp, alas, for monopolistic reasons, has limited the number of forwards you can have to a WhatsApp account as a way of trying to prevent that more secret forwarding of disinformation or incitement. And so I think that's important to put, again, those kinds of like checks, internal checks in the system. What we know from the research about ISIS in particular and its spread online was that it actually was a good idea to have it's not like you're going to stop people from spreading their ideas entirely. And like, we don't want that to happen. But if you make it harder, if you push them into less mainstream venues, if people have to go seek it out as opposed to having it like recommended to them on YouTube or through a Facebook group, that's better. It just ropes in fewer people who are like maybe persuadable, but not out there looking for it. And so the problem you described, while I think it's like a real one and worth taking seriously, I don't think it means that we should not try to limit lies and disinformation online. I think that's actually like a mistake.
And do we need a new way of thinking about lies and disinformation in the public square that helps people who aren't in this? Well, I guess I have two points. One, do we need a new way of thinking about it? Like the yelling fire in a crowded theater is a very helpful way of thinking about spreading disinformation and the immediate negative effects of that. And so do we need to come up with that way of thinking about how this takes hold? And then the second thing is, as you think about the big lie, one of the reasons the big lie exists is that the political market for behavior has gotten warped so that you can be a Josh Hawley or a Ted Cruz who only has to appeal to a pretty narrow audience. And that one of the problems we're trying to solve may be a political problem that's distinct from a speech problem. In other words, if you had a more healthy functioning system where lawmakers had to appeal to a broader audience, they would benefit less from narrow casting the fever swamps.
Yeah, I mean, I think those things are related, right? Like the first idea where you create a new kind of speech norm and you try to convince people that incendiary disinformation is like truly harmful, that's like a longer term project. People talk about media literacy, education. Happily, young people are better at spotting disinformation than older people. So maybe some of this will come out in the wash as more people who are like truly internet natives grow up. And this may be a sort of temporary problem for those reasons. That's like a hopeful way of thinking about it. But the fact that there is reward, not punishment, for the politicians and the leaders who are helping to spread the lie is militating against what I just said, right? The fact that like Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz have such a big television platform for spreading their ideas and that's adding to their stature in the party is not helpful. One thing I wanted to ask you guys about is the silence of President Trump since January 6th mostly, but especially since he left office. It is really different to have him out of the news environment. And right now it's a choice he's making. I mean, he could presumably call into a Fox show every single day if he felt like it. So part of me wonders if his lawyers or Mitch McConnell, and I say this with zero reporting, but someone has said to him, like, you need to cool it until after the impeachment if you want the Republicans to stick with you on this vote, and whether this is just a temporary reprieve. And part of me wonders if there's something else going on that might be longer term, and that even if Trump he's going to come back, that the media is going to figure out how to take a break from him and cover him differently. Because a lot of this is about his ability to shape television coverage through social media, not the social media itself, especially if he's like off on Parler, come back in some form or some other more fringy platform as opposed to Twitter or Facebook.
What's going on in his world. It has been quite a noticeable shift to feel that every progression of time is not subject to the immediate swerves and explosions as a result of both his behavior and the whipsawing of the news cycle after whatever he's doing. So I hope whatever it is continues. But it's clear that the market he created obviously still exists. One of the things I wonder about Parler and other places is whether you can go off and play in your own sandbox, but because negative partisanship is so much a part of politics today, and it's more a part of the Republican side, is it possible to own the libs if the libs aren't around? So if you own the libs in a forest, does it make a sound? And part of the joy in the people who act out is not that they're making...
It's such a great point. It's such a good point.
It's not the beauty of what they're saying. In fact, much of the time people will say, well, I know Donald Trump is not making any sense, or he's, you know, this is crazy, but they really enjoy the fact that he makes... liberals flap around. I keep going back to the Newt Gingrich line. He may not be a conservative, he said about Donald Trump, but he's the best anti-liberal I know. And so I don't know where this point is going other than to just sort of name something that I feel like I see. And also, by the way, the liberals need the same thing. All the people who kept quoting on Twitter things that were being said on Parler, you know, were demonstrating, it seems to me, the need to kind of keep sucking at that gap in the teeth, because they kind of enjoyed the crazy stuff that was being said because it gave them something to bounce off.
Yeah, I mean, I find one of the hardest challenges in journalism is like, how much attention do you give ideas that might be like a tiny number of people, but they're exciting in some way. Have you guys noticed this in the last week or so? There's been a ton of coverage of Marjorie Taylor Greene, the QAnon supporting member of Congress, and digging up of like old YouTube videos of hers. And like, it's bad. I mean, she said that, you know, Sandy Hook and the Parkland shootings were false flag operations. Like, it is not good. But like, how many people, like, are we giving her outsized attention? And is that just like a really bad idea?
I think we are giving her outsized attention. On the other hand, if the struggle of our day is between reality and fantasy, the fact that a person who engages in fantasy can get elected is should be worrying. And it would only be mildly worrying if it were an outlier. But fantasy led to the 6th of January. I mean, we are still in the smoldering wreckage of a lie creating actual violence. 140 Capitol Police are injured in one form or another as a result of complete detachment from reality. So she is perhaps a guppy in this school of fish, but there are some huge fish still swimming around.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
You definitely should not take investment advice from podcast hosts, certainly not hosts of this podcast. We on the GabFest do not tend to follow the markets. We leave that in the hands of wiser people. And this week, we need to call on one of those wiser people because there is such a crazy story happening in the financial markets. And we needed someone to help us understand it. And that someone we've called is Felix Salmon. Felix, of course, is the chief financial correspondent at Axios. He's also the host of Slate Money. He is here to explain the craziness around GameStop and the implications of the Reddit investment rebellion that's happening. So, Felix, can you start by just explaining in terms that even someone as dumb as me can understand what is happening now with GameStop? What is it? What is GameStop? What is happening to it? Who's doing it? Why is it happening now?
I'll try and keep this simple without trying to explain short selling, because you don't really need to understand that. The main thing you need to know is that GameStop is a beleaguered shopping mall retailer. It sells like two games for $5. It has been losing money for a while now. It has been shrinking. It has lots of debt. And it's a publicly listed company, so it has shares out on the open market. And a bunch of hedge funds looked at this and said, well, this company is going to zero. It has way too much debt. It has no future. And if it goes to zero, then the shares will wind up being worthless, or at least worth a lot less than they were. And so they decided to put on a bet that the shares were going to go down in value. And thus began this battle royale between the hedge fund managers on the one hand and the army of Redditors on the other, who formed on a subreddit called Wall Street Bets and then started memeing their way across the internet, TikTok and Twitter and YouTube and even Elon Musk's Twitter account, basically going out and saying, listen, all of these guys are making these bets that the stock is going down. If we just buy this stock in bulk, and if we buy it using leverage, and we put all of our stimulus checks into buying call options on GameStop stock, what that will do is it will drive the price higher, the hedge funds will lose billions of dollars, and we will make all of those billions of dollars. It's a simple zero-sum game. If the stock goes up, then the Reddit crew makes money and the hedge funds lose money. And if the stock goes down, then the hedge funds make money and the Reddit crew lose money. And so the battle was joined and the Redditors started buying and it started going up and it started going up and it started going up. And every time anyone thought it couldn't possibly go up any further, it went further. And as of Wednesday night, it is worth, I don't know, $25 billion or more. It's just been a crazy run in the markets. And this means that the hedge funds that bet against the company and the stock have lost lots of money. And there's a lot of schadenfreude going on.
So do we have to worry about this? I mean, I read a little around whether they're breaking any laws or not. Seems like probably it's not securities fraud, which, you know, you have to like deliberately try to pump up a stock in order to fool people. And that doesn't really seem to be what's going on. At least that's my reading of especially Matt Levine. Excellent.
Read Matt Levine, who does not give legal advice. No, I think you're right. If it's out, this is like, there's this classic Trumpian thing of like, if I incite an insurrection out in the open, then it can't be illegal. But like, in the case of market manipulation, it really does work like that. If you do something out in the open and you're not lying, you're all just saying, hey, let's go out and buy this stock, there's nothing illegal about doing that, as far as I can tell.
So What that leaves me with is this feeling of like, okay, so this sucked for this hedge fund. And I guess if this was going to keep going on and on with a lot of companies, and the idea of inflating the stock price of relatively valueless companies seems just like kind of weird and not necessarily what we want from the stock market. But beyond that, like, unless I'm worried that this is like going to mess with the market in some way that, you know, scrambles values and hurts lots of ordinary like pension fund and other investors, it just seems like kind of funny mischief making.
It is funny mischief making. I think you pretty much have your finger on it there. I don't see a lot of broad negative consequences of this, although there is no shortage of concern trolling on CNBC right now. There is no shortage of like Wall Street veterans going on the television and sucking their teeth and telling the Redditors that it's all going to end in tears. And they're like, I'm just looking out for you. You're going to lose your money, all of your money, if you carry on behaving like this. And the Redditors are like laughing and not taking anything seriously. And one of the things that really annoys the old school financial professionals is that they've basically lost this game against a team of people who aren't taking it seriously. And there's nothing which feels worse than losing a game against someone who isn't taking the game seriously. And these people are clearly not taking the game seriously. They're in it for the lulls, they're in it for the memes, and they're making money. And that just irks a bunch of financial pros and the CNBC types who are trying to find reasons to hate this. But I think you're right. There aren't that many reasons to hate this.
So Felix, how are they making money? So if I'm buying a stock and driving up the stock price, at some point, to make money, don't I have to sell at some point? And then if they all decide to sell, won't we head to the bottom pretty fast?
So that's true. Right now, a lot of
like
the gains are...
Like any good pyramid scheme.
I mean, yeah. So a bunch of people have taken profits. One thing that is worth noting is that on Wednesday, total volume in GameStop stock, and remember, this is a tiny company, was $31 billion. $31 billion of GameStop stock was sold. So it's not like no one is selling. A lot of people are selling in unprecedented volumes. There's total volume of Apple stock on a day that Apple announced its quarterly earnings was $19 billion, to put that in context. So if you want to sell, you can sell. There is a lot of liquidity here. And sure, in principle, if everyone all sold at the same time, then it would go down. But a lot of people have been selling. The stock is extremely volatile. It can go up and down from like $150 to $300 in one day. It's probably worth, on a fundamental basis, maybe like three, but no one cares. Right now, it's a little bit like Bitcoin, right? It's something which is worth whatever someone else is willing to pay for it.
Does that then make this a transfer of wealth between one Redditor to the other?
It's a transfer of wealth, really, from a bunch of hedge fund managers to a bunch of Redditors. And the hedge fund managers have lots of money and don't need it all, and the Redditors are largely much less rich, and they're going around saying, oh my God, now I can pay for surgery for my dog or something like that. And it's life-changing for these people, and that's awesome.
So Felix, I've listened to you on Slate Money talk about Robinhood and the rise of this sort of plebeian investor economy that they're all of us now can, you know, buy options and buy fractional stocks and not have pay any fees, and it's shaken things up. I wonder, the thing that troubles me about what's happening with GameStop is not that the Redditors are fleecing the hedge funders, which I'm all for, but that this is just another example of the huge overinvestment in American life in the finance economy. There's already too many people who work in finance. There's already so much intellectual energy, so much human capital deployed in finance. And now we have even more people, just regular citizens, doing this in their spare time when they could be doing almost anything else, which
they
would
be
more productive
to
society.
They could be reading poetry, David.
Yeah. Well, they could. I mean, yeah, I don't know if you're speaking ironically, but I do kind of feel that way. That it is that it, look, I'm for gambling. I'm for people going to Vegas. I'm for people playing around with their money if they can afford it. But it just feels like the finance economy is just too big a part of the of American life, and we shouldn't celebrate it becoming an even bigger part of people's everyday hobbies.
I think you're right. It's not necessarily something to celebrate, and there are dangers, and the concern trolls are not wrong when they say that it's probably all going to end in tears at some point. These people are not well diversified. This is a strategy that works until it doesn't. All of that, I just feel like in the middle of a pandemic, there are much bigger things to worry about, right? This is a game that people play on their phones when they're stuck at home and bored. This is what Matt Levine calls the boredom markets hypothesis, and it's not wrong. That the thing driving all of this is not some grand narrative of financialization of the American economy so much as it's a bunch of teens with phones and nothing better to do.
And I guess the other thing is that, you know, for years we've been hearing about these fancy financial products that Wall Street designs that have zero value in terms of like actually creating things in the world that make people's lives better. And this isn't exactly the same. It's not like some, you know, new securities derivative, but it's essentially creating value from the short bet of a hedge fund. And I just can't help but admire that a little bit. Like, it's some combination of creativity and chutzpah and collective action that has a certain appeal.
So to be clear, most of the activity here is going on in the options market, and that's where the real gains and losses are. The options market is a zero-sum game. The total amount of losses is always exactly equal to the total amount of gains. So you're not really creating that much value. And while it is certainly true that the market value of GameStop is high, and that's gone up, and that's value that's been created, it's not clear what GameStop can do with that. It's hard for them to like monetize it or make much use of it. So that's fine as far as it goes. It just doesn't go very far. But the real value is just in the fact that you're transferring money from a place where the marginal utility of an extra dollar is low, like, you know, in that pocket of Gabe Plotkin, who just spent $44 million buying a pair of houses in Miami Beach, and you're moving that dollar to a place where the marginal utility of money is high, in the, you know, pocket of someone for whom a $600 stimulus check is real money. And so you're increasing the value of money by doing that, you know, I hate to say it, Robin Hood thing of taking from the rich and giving to the poor.
Felix, was that the original reason behind this, or was it just to screw with the hedge fund guys who they felt were being sort of vulturistic by making bets about the death of a company?
What's interesting about Wall Street Bets is that it is a really quite positive and upbeat subreddit. It's not a bunch of mean, cackling meme lords who are trying, you know, seeking out short sellers to crush. They're basically just saying, hey, this is a rocket ship. Let's ride this to Mars. Let's ride it to the moon. And they're having fun with it. It is much more joyous than it is aggressive, I would say.
On Wednesday, Felix, the broader stock market had a huge decline, even as GameStop was going up into the stratosphere. Is there any connection between what's happening in the broader financial markets, stock market, and what's happening with GameStop? Are they just two different universes? You can't look at them together at all.
Everything is connected, and it's definitely true that the volatility of the market as a whole has gone up during these first crazy couple of weeks of 2021. And there does seem to be a little bit of contagion in that way. If a bunch of big professional institutional investors are losing money on those shorts, then they need to sell stocks somewhere else to make up that money, to make their margin calls. And so people are hypothesizing that perhaps part of the reason that the market broadly fell was because they would sell their, you know, IBM and General Electric stock in order to make up for the margin calls on their losses on AMC and GameStop. I don't know if I entirely believe that. There seems to be a little bit of like volatility contagion from them to the rest of the market, but I don't think it's enough to really concern yourself with.
Felix Salmon, of Axios is the host of Slate Money, which I'm sure will cover this in
We in will gory be covering it on Saturday on morning. Saturday. Tune in.
Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, David.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you've lost all your GameStop money, you're reduced to drinking the cheapest six-pack that you can find. What will you be chattering about on your decaying porch, Emily?
Okay, so I have a happy chatter and then a downer of a chatter. So my happy chatter is I read another book. It was so good. It was called A Children's Bible by Lydia Millett. And it's sort of a fable in some ways. It's kind of about our relationship with our planet, but it's also just about a bunch of interesting teenagers in a weird situation. It's kind of short. I totally recommend it. It's called, again, A Children's Bible by Lydia Millett. Okay, so that was my happy chatter. My bitter chatter this week, I'm going to break my own rule. So I think it's really important, as other folks like David Leonhardt at the Times have pointed out, to think of vaccines to be celebrated and not to get all wrapped up in the things going wrong. However, oh my God, Philadelphia, my hometown.
Oh my God.
Oh, I'm so mad at these people. Philadelphia signed a vaccine distribution contract with a startup called Philly Fighting COVID, a self-described group of college kids. These people are like getting my jerk award of the century.
It's the fire festival for vaccines.
Yes. They like gave out the vaccine to their friends. Like, meanwhile, nobody, as far as I know in Philadelphia, who's over 75, has gotten a vaccine. My parents sure cannot get a vaccine. And they were just like giving them out totally irresponsibly. They went to get for-profit status without telling the city. It's just like, it's just awful. Just don't be these people. Like, don't scam off of the vaccine, which like we really need to end this stupid pandemic. Just like, don't.
John.
But the good vaccine story is in Oregon, health workers were stranded in the snow, and rather than let the vaccine go bad, they started finding people and giving them the vaccine.
That is so much of a better story. Let's tell that story.
Yeah. So that's, I like that. That's a good
much
story.
Much better. You're right.
What's your chatter, John?
Yeah. My chatter is one that, David, you will join in, which is that people must set aside time to watch on Hulu in and of itself. Which is, I mean, David, how would you describe what it is in order not to totally screw it up? Because it's, if you say it's about magic, it's about so much more than that. It's about humanity and identity and... It's a one-man show by Derek Delgadio, and it was we saw it in New York live. I've seen the movie, which is incredibly powerful, so powerful that I get emotional watching just the trailer. But David,
it's incredible. I've been trying to find someone to talk to about this and some way to talk about it. And actually, the funny thing, listeners, is there is a brief Ann Dickerson cameo. I guess you guys were at a performance that was filmed, and there was Ann flashed across the screen. I texted her, and I was like, "Is that you?" And
oh my God, that's so awesome! I love that.
Maybe you were in it
that.
Too, John. I didn't see you. I don't know how to describe it. Because when you start to say magic, also there's a whole set of people whose faces fall when you start to say that, and it's not that, right. And it's incredible and weird and. I would love to have an evening discussing it with really smart people because I just don't know what to make of it and yet have been thinking about it for days.
And when she got that text from you, David, it launched us into a huge discussion again. We basically have these periodic discussions about it. And I can't, did she ever get back to you?
She called me and I didn't call her back because I was... She called me when I was in the middle.
Well, then you missed your chance for an excellent discussion. That was dumb.
I was in the middle of something. But it's, I mean, I think what's, I also would just advise people who watch it, it's like, please be sure to stay for the, it's only 90 minutes, but the last half, it really, like the last half hour is just 12 kicks in the head.
Yeah.
You've got to get
I'm
there.
I'm so excited for this. I saved it for the weekend once you guys started talking about it.
We went and saw it together, and then Anne went and saw it again. I was supposed to go with her, but we couldn't get enough tickets. So I think that might have been the show that she went to with our daughter instead of the one that we went to with our son. But yeah, I mean, it's really, I envy you, Emily, for your chance
My
to
ignorance.
See it with fresh eyes.
It's called In and of Itself on Hulu. My chatter. I have two quicky, cheerful chatters, very quick, both of them. One is I am re-listening to David Blight's Yale class, The Civil War and Reconstruction, which is available as a podcast. You have to kind of poke around for it. One of our listeners gave me the link. Thank you, listener. We can post the link. I listened to it, you know, probably 10 years ago. It's absolutely magnificent. You've heard David perhaps on our podcast. He's just an incredible historian and amazing talker. But this course is just, it's the grandest story of America and just like where a terrible, terrible moment and how it happened. And it's just, he does it so brilliantly and so compellingly. I look forward to like, oh, I'm have my morning walk. So I get to listen to two David Blight lectures this morning. So please check it out. The other quick chatter is I want to recommend a project that Marketplace did. Marketplace, the public radio show, asked a Minneapolis rapper named Dessa, who's a friend of mine as well, by coincidence, to write a song about Janet Yellen, the new Secretary of the Treasury. And they asked Dessa, I think, because Dessa had been on the Hamilton mixtape, and they were like, Hamilton, you know, there was this great musical about the Treasury Secretary once, and now we have this new Treasury Secretary. Wouldn't it be good to have a song about the new Treasury Secretary? And Dessa wrote just such a fun, great song. And I think we're going to play a little sample from that now.
Oh, who's yelling now? Who's yelling? Who's yelling now? Doves on the left, hawks on the right, crosstalk in the flock, trying to fight mid-flight. But here comes yelling with that inside voice. Never mind the mild manner, policies make noise. She's 5 foot nothing, but hands are God. She could pop a collar, she could rock a power bob. Bay Ridge represent, Brooklyn's in the cabinet. Damn, Janet, go and get it, fifth in line for president. She knows the kind of stimulus it takes to pass the
block. I
heard
she called the house in crisis.
She's qualified.
It only took a couple centuries, the first female secretary of the treasury.
It is
lots of love for that song.
It is so great. It is so great. It's so funny. Listeners, you continue to send us great listener chatters. You tweet them to us at Slate Gabfest. So many good ones. And we've decided to do something new because we are so glad of your suggestions. We're now going to ask you to do the chatter yourself. So we are trying something new this week. I picked out a listener chatter from Gael Phobes. And Gael Phobes, take it away.
Hi, Emily, David, and John. This is Gael. I'm a student up at Syracuse University, and my listener chatter for this week is a wonderful tweet thread from Joaquin Campa, and he compiled a whole bunch of photos of animals interrupting wildlife photographers who are trying to do their job. And my favorite photo is number 7, which is a cheetah cub who is resting on a photographer's shoulders. Thanks so much for taking this chatter.
I love this. This is the best idea ever, whoever's idea this was.
I think it's Bridget's idea. Good idea, Bridget.
Gold star. Add this to your collection.
That's our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Gabriel Roth is editorial director of Slate Audio. June Thomas is managing producer. And Alicia Montgomery is executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Slate Gabfest and tweet chatter to us there. And perhaps you will end up doing your chatter, if you want to, on the show. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We will talk to you next week. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? If you are John Dickerson, you are undoubtedly in the midst of an organizational project, or you are sharpening your pencils, which you have bought for $150 per pencil somewhere.
No, they're not expensive.
Or you have a cloth-bound notebook that was, you know, cloth that was gathered from miners in the original Comstock lode in 1849 because their cloth makes the best binding for any possible notebook. But I'm making fun of you, John, but you are a man of process. And we were asked this week about your process by listener Mark.
Hi, Emily, John, and David. This is Mark Rotenstrike from New York City. Last week, John mentioned that he's transitioning from Evernote to OneNote, and I'm really curious to know why. I like Evernote a lot and am trying to use it more because I'm forever struggling to to keep track of everything. So now, having heard John say that, I'm wondering what he knows that I don't. Also, I'm curious to know what apps and tools the three of you use to keep track of information and to organize your work and personal lives. So thanks for sharing that information, and thanks also for the great weekly shows.
I think the biggest, most important thing I ever learned was reading David Allen's Getting Things Done, and it was basically to have some structure for capturing ideas. So it seems to me that the basic, most important organizational thing is capturing and follow through, because you need to have a place you can capture things so when you have a thought, it doesn't go away, because A, you lose the thought, and then B, you over time accrue this feeling like, my life is a sieve, and I'm just not on top of anything. If at least you have a set of tricks for capturing, that diminishes that idea. And then you have to follow through, which is to say, when you capture it, it can't just like stay in a notebook. You have to actually do something with it. You don't have to do it immediately necessarily. One of the things I'd spent some time over the break doing was going back through as I switched from Evernote to OneNote. And the quick answer to that is just far more, it has the functionality I need. You can highlight on pages much, much, much better. You can move stuff around more easily. Organizational is just grooves much more with the way I do things. So then those are my basic things. What I really need, though, from you two guys or anyone else is a better way for capturing information from like newsletters, reading papers. I feel like I don't have the beauty of what used to be when you got one newspaper, which is you felt at the end of the day, even if you just leafed through the pages, like you had some sense of the whole world. And everything drives us to such narrowness. I sometimes like feel like I could miss entire huge stories that are, you know, in the business section and not just in my narrow feed.
Can I ask a OneNote question before we tackle that one? So my question about OneNote, is it easy to cut and paste? I abandoned Evernote because I found that it was laborious to cut and paste stories online, and like photos and charts didn't move easily, and it just irritated me.
Yeah, the editing function in Evernote is a mess. They also upgraded Evernote and took away all the functions I liked the most. It's pretty easy. The web clipper from Evernote is pretty good. So basically, if you're reading an article and you want to send it to Evernote, you just hit one button.
That does sound good.
Yeah, it also has nice syncing with Instapaper if people use that, where you when you read something in Instapaper and you highlight it, you can set up a rule that basically dumps all of your highlights into Evernote. And then you can merge those more easily. One of OneNote's limitations is you can't merge as easily, but I find that for me, color and emojis of all things are really useful in quickly looking at a page that has lots going on and kind of focusing on what I need that's important. And the editing on OneNote pages is so much better. I've just written two scripts in the last couple of weeks, which is just like a story for print, but I don't know, somehow different. But anyway, where you have, you know, a massive, massive transcript and you're trying to take out the bits you want to use in your writing. And it just worked so beautifully. I like the editor on OneNote better. And it's more like if you had it on physical pieces of paper in front of you.
David, do you have an answer to John's question about being comprehensive, at least in some way, about the world?
No, I don't. I think you guys are both writers, and I'm not really a writer anymore. And so the way I'm a project manager. That's what being a CEO is a lot of the time. And so I work in project management software, which in my case right now is Airtable and Dropbox.
I don't even know what that is.
And Google Docs. Airtable, it's a software that you use to manage a project to keep on top of it. And so that's what the brilliant project manager at CityCast has put us on, and it's really useful. But I don't have that same need to store every bit of information around a particular story or particular thing that you guys do. So I outsource my memory to Google Docs and Google and Gmail mostly, but I don't have that same need, so I don't use it.
But do you survey the world in some way or no?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I don't either. I let myself off the hook of surveying the world. I kind of rely on the bits that are going to interest me or are really important to come float my way, like from my family or something. I don't even, yeah. And I sort of also just let myself off the hook of thinking that I have to know something about a lot of headlines. It's actually like, I think it's a relief to decide that you don't actually need to know what's going on and that someone can be talking about some big news story and you can just be like, what's that? And then you can sound like an idiot, but then they'll tell you and that's okay.
The other thing I've learned, which is, I don't know if this is, I've always been this way or I've learned it or this is a result of age, but I often feel like what's inside the computer screen is not really under my control. So if I'm writing a piece like in a single day and I have a deadline, it's all kind of contained in the piece, you know. It's all just kind of right there on one screen, and that's pretty easy. Or if you're making a pretty simple argument. But when the argument's more complex or you've interviewed lots and lots of different people, or God forbid, it's a book, I feel like there's lots that's kind of lost inside the swimming screen, and I physically need to have, you guys may remember the huge roller paper I had on which I used to write outlines. But basically, if I could build a perfect office, one wall would be basically like a huge sheet of paper and one wall would be a bulletin board on which to peg things. Because I need to have the serial killer hunter's wall on which you like have red strings. And I need to outline some ideas on a piece of paper without constraints in order to figure out how they connect. In fact, I will now hold up, sorry, those of you who are
visual
listening,
display.
But I mean, this is me trying to work out the a tricky part of the recent piece I was working on, and it worked, but it didn't work going up and down. It's kind of it's basically a bunch of words and circles and squares on a huge piece of art paper.
You know what's funny is that both the serial killer hunter and the serial killer have the same methodology. Serial killers also have those huge bulletin boards and like planning out, and then the serial killer hunter does too. It seems like maybe they should work together and there could be one product that both of them could use.
Huh. I don't know how well that would end for the serial killers, but I guess maybe that would be another advantage. I totally know what you mean, John, about, I actually don't have a bulletin board, but I feel like when you're with a big project, being able to...
That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.